Welcome to this seminar. It's our great pleasure to welcome Margot Solomon from the Law Department. She's an associate professor in the Law Department, and she is a member of the Center for the Study of Human Rights here at the school. She directs the Center's Laboratory for Advanced Research on the Global Economy. She is comfortable working across disciplines, which is very helpful for this evening. We are a mixed disciplinary audience. Margot has been a consultant to the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights in 2009. She's been a consultant to the World Bank's Nordic Trust Fund on Human Rights and Economics, an advisor to the UN High Level Task Force on the Right to Development, and a member of the International Law Association's Committee on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. She is currently vice chair of the Association of Human Rights Institutes, and her recent publications include Of Austerity, Human Rights and International Institutions, published in the European Law Journal this year. Very kindly, Margot supplied some recent papers, which you're welcome to take away. One such is that Margot wrote a legal brief for the, quote, Special Committee of the Hellenic Parliament on the Audit of the Greek Debt, parenthesis, the Debt Truth Committee. I should also mention that this Thursday, the Law Department will be hosting the former president of the Greek Parliament, Zoe Konstantopoulou, which is in the Sheikh Zayed Theatre at 6:30.
Yeah.
Are tickets still available?
Yeah, it's unticketed. It's a first-come, first-serve.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great. But to give us the intellectual preliminary this evening, we welcome Margot to speak about Of Austerity, Human Rights and International Institutions. And Margot has very kindly agreed to speak for about 45 minutes. We're flexible.
Okay.
But that should still give us plenty of time for a discussion afterwards.
Okay, welcome. Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Kevin. And it's, I'm delighted to be here and to I'm really grateful for the Hellenic Observatory having reached out to me to present this work that I've been working on probably for about the last year, or maybe year and a half, in terms of the research that culminated in this article in the European Law Journal. And I'm not actually a European lawyer. I'm an international lawyer, an international human rights lawyer. And so this merges across legal regimes, my work, but also to some degree, to quite a large degree, across disciplinary regimes. Although tonight what I thought I would do and what I thought might be helpful is to, in a way, distill and present some of the key questions and some of the key findings, if you will, from the two papers, focusing in particular on the role of international institutions that are implicated in the humanitarian crisis or social crisis that's come to pass in Greece. And I'll offer some reflections as well. And at the end, during the question and answer, some of you might have questions on the work. You might have broader questions. Many of you are expert on Greece in a way that I'm not. So I welcome those questions. And indeed, some of you might have some questions on the Debt Truth Committee. And I can tell you my views and some insights about that. Although tonight, of course, I speak in my individual capacity and present this work as an academic, and it's my own work, and that's it. So the two pieces that I'll draw on is this European Law Journal article, which I wrote about a year ago, but I also wrote with Professor Olivier de Schutter, who's a Belgian academic at the Université de Louvain, this legal brief. And the legal brief builds on that article, but also is more narrow, more doctrinal, and attempts very systematically, and in a way, I mean, perhaps not in a boring way, but in a quite a straightforward way. It's not meant to be a narrative or even reflective. It's really meant to be an attempt to map legal obligations, and in particular, potential legal responsibility, the roots of international legal responsibility. And by international legal responsibility, I mean liability for the harms that have come to pass in Greece. So I'm going to sort of walk us through that with some broader reflections on the way. And before I do, I guess the final point is just to say that what led me to this research, in short, is, you know, historically and recently, my work focuses on poverty and development and questions of global economic justice and the contribution and limits of international human rights law to those concerns and those issues. And that has led me traditionally to focus on so-called developing countries and not on Europe. Europe was implicated in that sort of as in a particular way, but really as a exporter of capitalist values, a capital exporter and a capitalism exporter. But really the heart of my focus was on the impacts and on the legal parameters of poverty and development as a question of international law, given its implications in developing countries. But of course, as we know, these questions now have, in a sense, come home to roost, and the debt crisis here has been significant. So my research focuses, in fact, less on the debt crisis itself and more on the responses to the debt crisis and the social catastrophe that emerged as a result of those particular responses. Okay, so to begin, begin at the beginning. There's extensive data from a range of sources, as you'll all know, detailing the negative impacts on the exercise of socioeconomic rights on the people of Greece as a result of macroeconomic adjustment conditions that were required for the provision of financial assistance since 2010. And that's the time period that I focus on, really this last period. And the human rights impacted cover a range of labor rights, the right to social security, the right to health and health care, the right to an adequate standard of living, the right to housing, and also gender equality, among others. And their empirical findings are available. Readily unprecedented rise in unemployment. Youth employment, I think, is currently at 52%, 25% increase in the country's homeless population since 2009. There is an extremely interesting book and a set of articles by the same authors in peer-reviewed journals that point to a 200% rise in the incidence of HIV/AIDS in Greece over the same period due to cutbacks in relation to health care, the return of mother-to-child transmission of HIV due to cutbacks where routine screens are no longer conducted on present women, the return of malaria that Greece hasn't seen since the pre-war period. And the findings indicate that particular groups were disproportionately affected by the adjustment, and these include women and the young, as well as pensioners. The memorandum of understanding concluded by Greece, concluded with the Troika by Greece in 2010 and 2012 and now 2015, made the conditions for access to loans contingent on the implementation of a range of measures, including fiscal consolidation, i.e. austerity. And the international actors that are implicated and potentially responsible or co-responsible for human rights violations are numerous, mostly acting, as I said, as international creditors. So one of the first things I did in my original paper, but then in a way far more rigorously in that exercise of mapping responsibility in the paper with Olivier, was really to look at these loan agreements and to see who the international creditors were and are. And frankly, it was a reasonably onerous exercise. In a way, now the information is readily available. There's been so much written on Greece. But it's not at all obvious and in some ways extremely complicated. So the first thing we did was to find out exactly who these international creditors were and are. And so the paper deals with, and what I'll look at tonight in large part, are the various creditors and their international human rights obligations. And these include the Euro area member states, the European Commission, the European Central Bank, the Council of the European Union, the EU member states, the IMF, the member states of the IMF, the European Stability Mechanism now, and the ESM member states. Greece also has human rights obligations at home, and I'll address those two in brief. And I'll move on now to say something about what's required. So the place I want to start is with what's required in the crafting of economic policies if it's to be human rights compliant. And then I want to look at the various actors and what international human rights law requires of them or does not require of them. And so to get a sense of the obligations and what's required, we're going to focus for tonight, and as I do in large part, not exclusively, in my paper on the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. It's the main international treaty under the auspices of the UN. It's widely ratified. It's a jurisprudential and doctrinal trendsetter. All EU member states, all Eurozone states have ratified the treaty, and there's 164 states parties to it. So it's a good place to get a sense of what we're talking about. So I want to begin with just flagging and giving a sense of some of the core doctrines when we talk about socioeconomic rights and what's required in ensuring them, including in the context of economic policy making and economic policy thinking. So the first is the idea of minimum essential levels of rights. And the point here is really that progressive realization, there's recognition that socioeconomic rights can be progressively realized where there are resource implications. But the idea of progressive realization notwithstanding, the Committee on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights that oversees this treaty has recognized, and it's now part of their jurisprudence, that there are core obligations that give rise to minimum essential levels of rights and that these require immediate action. So the first point is that there's a bare minimum, a threshold, that requires immediate attention. Back in 1990, the Committee on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, this UN committee, stated in this regard, and I quote, "A state party in which any significant number of individuals is deprived of essential foodstuffs, of essential primary health care, of basic shelter and housing, or of the most basic forms of education, is prima facie failing to discharge its obligations under the covenant. If the covenant were to be read in such a way as not to establish such a minimum core obligation, it would be largely deprived of its raison d'etre." We see just last month, 2 months ago, October, this committee adopted its concluding observations, its review of Greece. And at paragraph 23, it talks about the failures to ensure social security coverage in line with the requirements of the covenant. And the committee says in particular that Social Security has largely been inadequate to ensure a decent standard of living, a decent standard of living. And I flag that because, and this sort of introduces some more sort of theoretical or reflective considerations, and that is while the committee has understandably focused on minimum standards, basic needs, that surely cannot be enough, and we don't stop there. And the idea that the committee has used the language of decency is to introduce, in my view, a decency standard. Decency is far more. What's required for a decent life is surely far more than basic housing and just enough to eat. So I think the idea of decency is worth keeping in mind when we think about what's required. Okay, maximum available resources. In considering an alleged failure by a state party, and at the moment we have in mind Greece, but we're going to extrapolate and look at the international creditors in a little while. In considering an alleged failure of the state party to take steps to realize rights in the covenant, the committee indicated in 2007 that it would examine the measures that the state had taken to see whether they were adequate or reasonable to achieve the ends. And what they said was that they would likely include a number of questions in making this evaluation about whether the so-called maximum available resources have been used, language that's found in the treaty itself and that requires action on the part of the state. So they would include the extent to which the measures were targeted, in fact, towards fulfilling rights. Targeted directly towards fulfilling rights. I think this is significant, and probably more significant than it suggests, obvious as it is that much of the discussion around economic policy presupposes, if it supposes anything at all, that by stimulating the economy, by addressing the debt, by a range of particular austerity policies, that things will get better. And over the longer term, at some undefined time in the future, rights, if they're framed that way at all, will be fulfilled. And here the onus is on and the focus is on actually not having economic policy as a precondition for rights, but having rights as the first point of call and our first focus. It's something that I'll return to a little later. That policies don't discriminate against any particular group. That the policy adopted takes on the least restrictive option and least restricts covenant rights in its framing. In order to meet this test, states have to consider disadvantaged and marginalized individuals. The committee would want to know that they've been taken into account. They'd want to know that situations of grave risk have been prioritized. So these are some of the questions that are asked around the use of resources and whether they've used their maximum resources. So a range of sort of procedural questions about allocation and priorities and vulnerability and marginalization. The principle of non-retrogression. So there's a strong presumption that retrogressive measures on the part of a state are not permitted, clawing back your rights, reducing your rights. And potentially retrogressive measures could include cuts to expenditures on public services that are essential for the realization of economic and social rights. According to the committee, any proposed policy change has to meet a number of requirements. So these requirements include that the policy is temporary, covering the crisis period only. We tend to see sort of permanent or long-term austerity measures in place without the proper sort of consideration of when they might be reversed, never mind the basis upon which they were implemented in the first place. In the concluding observation, in this the report on Greece by the committee that just came out 2 months ago, the committee concluded that Greece should progressively waive austerity. So it speaks to this idea of temporary policy measures, that the policy must be necessary and proportionate, in that any other policy adopted would be more detrimental to rights. Policies have to be non-discriminatory, and the policy must identify this minimum core of rights. Non-discrimination, a short word on non-discrimination. So states are required to ensure non-discrimination is respected, and for example, to undertake to ensure the equal rights of men and women to enjoy the covenant rights. And the key point here for current purposes is that the prohibition on discrimination applies also to indirect discrimination. And what's indirect discrimination? Laws, policies, practices, economic policies, which appear neutral on the face of it but have a disproportionate impact on the exercise of rights with regards to a particular group. In the case of Greece, this was undoubtedly the case, that there was this disproportionate impact, far from ensuring that the pain of the Troika's bailout terms was endured equally between men and women. The burden fell disproportionately on the latter, and this is true especially in terms of the impact of the growing level of unemployment, move to part-time work and rotational contracts, women suffering additional problems of discrimination in trying to enforce their maternity rights, and so on. So discrimination and indirect discrimination. Responding to some of the challenges about this, so I put in this slide a little while ago when I was thinking about this, because in discussing this with different types of lawyers, different types of people, and here in this case, an EU lawyer, he said, well, non-retrogression sounds great in theory, but of course it constrains the possibility of governments to make policy decisions. They have to have a free hand to decide what's best with the tools and the situation at their disposal, and it ties the hands of democratically elected governments, he said, the idea that basically they're limited in terms of the policies that they can apply and decide on. And to this I would answer the following, that the principle of non-retrogression, if properly understood and properly applied, should not unduly circumscribe the flexibility of a state to respond to economic crises. But what it does do is the following. It signals the primacy of human rights. Second, it forces a government to justify rights reductions. And thirdly, it foregrounds the requirement that no one falls below a certain standard. A second argument that we hear a lot is that the measures are in the general interest. I touched on this before, this idea about reducing rights for some satisfaction, some guarantee to emerge at some undetermined time in the future. Financial stability and the terms under which it's allegedly been attempted by the Troika in Greece, social spending cuts, labor rights reversals, this whole idea of flexible labor, reduction in collective bargaining, security of employment to increase competitiveness. These are not economic truths. These are not neutral policies. They reflect values and they reflect explicit policy choices. The policy choices in Greece under the 2010 and 2012 MOUs failed on their own terms in the first instance to cut government debt or to stimulate the economy and stimulate economic growth. In fact, it was quite the opposite. But even had they succeeded on the basis of these narrow economic metrics, they may not have been human rights compliant. They may not have been in the general interest. In order for us to determine whether these decisions were in the general interest, we have to ask a number of questions. We have to factor in a number of elements. One of these is, well, who will gain and who will lose? There's no such thing as the general interest in a very broad sense. Who will gain and who will lose? There's no aggregate person. There's no general interest. Is it women? Is it migrants? Is it youth? Is it pensioners? Is it public servants? Who? What are the trade-offs? Moreover, it's not a given that, as I've mentioned, that these aggregate gains, this public interest, is even consistent with human rights, because human rights doesn't allow this trade-off into an unknown future. It requires far more rigorous policy making than that. So when we consider the general interest, a related question is how were the burdens shared? And indeed, first question, whether the burdens were shared. Second point on the general interest, we need to be clear on setting red lines. What are those red lines? The general interest today, I'll propose to you, is in some significant ways coterminous with the idea of human rights. So we go back to our first principles on the last slide. Were minimum standards met so that people can live in conditions of dignity and decency, etc.? What we've seen in Greece has been quite the opposite and captured quite tragically and beautifully by the anthropologist Arturo Escobar when he said in the context of development several decades ago, what we have here are policies that really say, press on with structural reforms while we bracket off people's welfare and thousands die. That's what we've seen in this fallacy of the general interest. So how to think about responsibility? So now it's a little bit of a lecture somehow, like I give to my students to run through this. But of course, speaking to people who have all sorts of insights on the way this plays out, so I'll really welcome your reflections. But let's go through what the different actors were that were involved in this crisis. Public actors, Greece. So Greece is bound. Now we're talking about their obligations and therefore their potential liability. Greece is bound by domestic human rights law, its constitution and so forth, and the international treaties that it's ratified. And it's ratified a number of European treaties that protect social rights, as well as the International Covenant on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, Convention on the Rights of the Child that includes social rights, and so on. So Greece cannot argue that other international obligations, the obligations, the conditionalities that it's undertaken as part of the loan agreements, displace its human rights obligations. The human rights obligations are something that have to be brought to bear in its subsequent negotiation. There was a set of decisions against Greece by the Social Rights Committee under the European Social Charter, a different judicial, quasi-judicial body, in 2012, where Greece was found to have violated the right to social security due to its austerity measures, as alleged by the complainant. In its defense, Greece argued, among other things, that the modifications of the pensioner's social protection, which was the issue at stake, result from the government's other international obligations, namely those deriving from a financial support mechanism agreed upon by the government together with the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the IMF, the Troika, in 2010. So the European Committee of Social Rights properly rejected this argument in its introductory remarks in the case. And to the government's argument that its human rights obligations should be displaced, it said, the rights safeguarded under the 1961 Charter have been restricted pursuant to its other international obligations, namely those under the loan agreement with the EU institutions and the IMF and so forth, Greece says. And the committee replies that the contested provisions of domestic law seek to fulfill the requirements of other legal obligations do not remove them from the ambit of the Charter. In short, human rights cannot be displaced. What Greece sought to do was to blame human rights violations on its international creditors. The big point here is that Greece remains responsible for its own human rights obligations, regardless of what responsibilities other actors might have. And there are a number of other actors. The Eurozone states. So the first loan to Greece during this last period was in 2010, which was accompanied, as usual, by conditionalities under the Memorandum of Understanding. And that 2010 loan, as some of you will know, was in the form of a pooled bilateral loan from the Eurozone states. So to a certain degree, this is quite straightforward when we think about the obligations and the potential responsibilities. Several international human rights instruments to which these states have acceded, these Eurozone states, include obligations effectively to the people of Greece, what we call extraterritorial obligations, obligations not only that they have to their own people, but also, in a more narrow sense, but in many ways in a clear sense, obligations they have to others, including obligations of international assistance and cooperation under the covenant. So what this would require is an obligation of Eurozone states, in the crafting of the conditionalities, in the sign-off of the conditionalities, which they ultimately did, to respect the rights of the people of Greece, i.e., quite simply, to do no harm, an obligation to do no harm in the agreements that they undertake and the conditionalities that they imposed. And the obligations that the Eurozone states had with regards to the 2010 memorandum included avoiding conduct that would put Greece in a position not to be able to fulfill its own obligations to the people of Greece or to the people in Greece. So two ways to think about that. So in principle, the Eurozone states can be held responsible for any breach of their international human rights obligations. Quite straightforward. The 2012 loan to Greece came under the auspices of a different type of vehicle. Here we had the European Financial Stability Fund. And the EFSF was set up as a special purpose vehicle by Eurozone states, but it was created as a company incorporated in Luxembourg. So what human rights lawyers call a non-state actor, effectively not a state, a private entity. Under a number of human rights treaties, states, and this includes all Eurozone states, are required to do all that's in their power to ensure that actors under their control or influence do not engage in acts that violate human rights. So in this sense, quite simply, the Eurozone states, acting as shareholders of this private company, had an obligation, we say, an obligation to protect, the people of Greece from harms that would befall them from human rights violations at the hand of third parties, at non-state actors over which they exercise control, and they exercise control as the sole shareholders of.
Just a question. When you say harms, you mean human rights violations?
I mean human rights violations.
Harms.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Yes.
I mean beyond human rights violations?
No. No. I'm using them interchangeably. Yeah. 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 The company itself, not having human rights obligations, could cause harms in a formal sense. It would be the responsibility of the states that exercise influence over that entity to ensure that it doesn't cause harms. But they're not violations. They're violations of the state for failing to address what this non-state actor is doing. So in that sense, they're formally harms, if you understand, if you appreciate the difference. But we're talking about effectively the same thing, so you're absolutely right. Okay, so protect protect the people of Greece, in this case Greece, from the actions of non-state actors over which they exercise control. And that's, again, quite straightforward in the case, straightforward in terms of sort of a narrow line of responsibility. The EFSF, the Financial Stability Facility, has been succeeded now by the European Stability Mechanism, which is not a company, is now an intergovernmental organization outside of the EU legal order. So I'll return to that in a minute. EU institutions. So the EU institutions established under the EU treaties, now we turn to the Troika, have played a decisive role in the implementation of the successive loans provided to Greece, including in the case of the EC and ECB, the negotiation of the MOUs, and the supervision of loan agreements. Under normal circumstances, the EU institutions will be bound by the Charter of Fundamental Rights, which provides for a range of social solidarity rights, even if their language there is somewhat weaker than we have at the international level. One unresolved issue that has come up in the context of the Greek crisis, and is of quite significant importance, is the possibility that EU institutions, and now I'm thinking of the Troika members of the EC and the ECB, that they could do outside of the EU that which they cannot do within the EU. They were effectively borrowed to work in negotiating and overseeing these loans, borrowed by these different entities. All these different lending vehicles borrowed the EC and the ECB. And the EC and ECB are bound by the Charter of Fundamental Rights. So the question is, are they still bound when actually undertaking their usual roles, but undertaking them effectively outside of the EU legal order? The position that now enjoys widespread support among legal commentators, the Committee on Constitutional Affairs of the European Parliament, and others, was that an EU institution, quite simply, was bound by the full extent of EU law, including the Charter of Fundamental Rights, also when acting outside of the EU itself. Okay, we move on. Intergovernmental organizations. Okay. So, first, we think about intergovernmental organizations, the IMF and the European Stability Mechanism, as international organizations. They have basic human rights obligations. This is an evolving area. I think it's fair to argue that they would have obligations to respect the principles and rules concerning the basic rights of the human person. They are not party to the human rights treaties in a formal sense, but there are general principles of basic rights that would apply to any actor, and these would apply to the organizations as organizations. 10 minutes. I'm going to move ahead. Let me jump. Members of the international organizations, again, states, parties. Here we have states who have a whole host of obligations under all sorts of treaties, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Covenant on ESC Rights. The member states of the international organizations bring those obligations with them into the organizations when they're making decisions. We recognize fully this hasn't been the case, but as a matter of law, they're required to bring those obligations with them in their other activities, in their other cooperative arrangements. What should we expect of these various actors? One of the things that struck me when I was doing this research was the total disregard for human rights, and that none of the actors involved, none of these creditors, had even taken the elementary precaution of assessing the potential impacts on the level of enjoyment of human rights of the measures that they were recommending, or in some cases, in most cases, requiring that they were adopted, not even elementary. And there's a range of places. The ones I've cited here are, let's say, soft law norms. They have the endorsement of the UN, the main human rights body within the UN, a range of principles, and that's now something that's standard in international environmental law, this idea of impact assessment to avoid conduct that would foreseeably violate rights. If you're going to avoid conduct that foreseeably violate rights, you have to assess before you violate those rights what kind of conduct may lead to that. So in the interest of time, I won't go through, but we capture the idea here of foreseeability and risk, and none of this was undertaken. Just recently, a few months ago, the UN Committee on Discrimination Against Women also reviewed Greece and was shocked by the failure to assess impact on women and called on the creation of an observatory within Greece that would be made up of all the various policymakers, and here they list not only Greece but the European Union institutions and the IMF, to evaluate fully the impact on women of the ongoing crisis. In short, the IMF didn't compensate for the failure of other creditors, and the IMF undertook its own study about the impact of its policies on the poor, and saw that in 9 of 18 countries, conditionality affected the prices of products consumed by the poor. We know historically that there's been a massive problems, structural adjustment in the 80s and 90s, effectively with comparable policies that decimated lives, privatization of social services, fees on access to health care, and cuts and other things. So, in fact, it may be simplistic to say, but I wonder really how much impact assessment was actually needed when there's 30 years of history of comparable measures having been imposed. And not least of all, they could have looked at what happened with their policy recommendations in 2010 before they implemented comparable ones in 2012 or again in 2015. So the idea that they didn't know is an impossibility, and the papers and blogs are full of speculation on why these policies were imposed, but I think every reasonable economist and most lawyers know that it wasn't because it was good for the economy or good for the people. It was interesting that when I was in Athens on one of my sort of meetings with colleagues working on these issues, there was a hearing with Panagiotis Roumeliotis, who is Greece's former representative, executive director to the IMF, an alternate executive director to the IMF in 2010. And there's a paper in the papers that we received where he says to the IMF that my authorities are committed to an equitable and fair distribution of the adjustment burden. We're committed to making sure the most vulnerable are looked after. We're aware that these burdens have to be shared in a very particular way, and so forth. And he was asked there about the truth of this document that was submitted. And he said during his testimony, in Athens, he said, no, in fact, I didn't see any measures to protect those groups. On the contrary, they saw cuts. No one said the minimum wage should not be reduced, and it was. To say we'll protect the most vulnerable groups is theoretical. Instead, they suffered the most. The results were an increase in unemployment, an increase in poverty. We did not work on protecting the vulnerable social groups, and what we saw was their further marginalization. Yes, there was a general reference in the first MOU to protecting the most vulnerable, but in the IMF meetings, they go measure by measure and discuss, for example, how to reach the target deficit, the primary surplus, etc. There is no discussion on vulnerable social groups. Social impact assessment, the EU, the EC, has done some thinking on that, but it was absent from any kind of arrangements in their oversight system in the 5 years. A late assessment now came out in August with regards to the 2015 MOU that a preliminary reading would suggest is insufficient. The failure to undertake social impact assessment is more than an indifference, I suggest, to international human rights law procedurally and substantively. And where it was done, for example, in this August 2015 paper by the EC, concludes that a stable macroeconomic and policy environment is a precondition for living standards and improving social conditions. This is to miss a key point, I think, to draw these kinds of conclusions. Findings show that securing socioeconomic rights is very good for the economy and for the sharing of its gains. According to an interesting study by Stuckler and Basu, It's health and education that, in fact, offer the greatest so-called fiscal multipliers, where every dollar invested in these programs returns three back in economic growth. Human rights provide an instrumental benefit in that they offer a strong foundation for macroeconomic performance, and they represent an intrinsic good in that the people and their dignity and their well-being are valued. So here is the idea captured that human rights are a precondition, a point I raised at the very start. What we've seen instead is something else entirely, where rights are being resituated so as to be understood as dependent upon the capacity of the capitalist or indeed the neoliberal order, inverting the logic that underpins human rights as first-order principles, the realization of which should shape our economic arrangements. I think I'll skip. With my now 5 minutes or 4.5 minutes left, I think, and this is something, you know, we can discuss in the Q&A, a lot of the focus is on this idea that that there are so few alternatives. And we see the literature now rich with suggestions of all sorts of alternatives to what's going on now. We see ideas around a determination as to which sectors are critical for society and should be left out of conventional privatization schemes, or left out of the hands of the private sector, and encouraged in different ways. The Marxist Indian economist Pravik Patnaik wrote a fantastic article in the context of India, but much of this could be replicated in other parts of the world, with a focus on land reforms, on protection of peasant agriculture, cooperatives, and so on, concessions whereby entertaining private project proposals will not take place. So a ceiling what he calls a reservation price. And I think quite interesting, and the finance minister, Tsakalotos, mentioned this in his talk here just a few weeks ago when he spoke of the fact that he dreams of an experiment of a social and solidarity economy. It's notable, of course, that he only dreams of it, which in my view suggests how little we can hope for in the current situation from Syriza. There's really interest, in the interest of time, I won't go into the very interesting thinking and work going on what the social and solidarity economy would mean. So I think I'm going to wrap up just by jumping to my last slide, and I think I'm only missing one, which sort of suggests it applies what I've just discussed, ideas of non-retrogression, for example, burden sharing, and how, through impact assessment, international creditors could take these on board. These are minimalist requirements, right? This isn't the idea that they would take on board the full range of human rights or even be burdened by them. In fact, in subsequent work, I'll probably jettison this whole idea and say they're far too minimalist. So for current purposes, there's so much we could have expected from them that is so basic and preliminary, and for which there was an entire failure. And this is not new to these institutions. When we think of the IMF, and colleagues here who work on similar areas will know how there's been decades with academics and particularly NGOs banging their head against the walls of the World Bank and IMF, talking about how they were required to comply with human rights and on what legal basis they make those arguments. Let me wrap up with a few little reflections on some of the perils that have emerged in the main from my reflections and my consideration of the tragedy that we've seen in Greece and in Europe. First is the peril of ignoring history. So as I've just mentioned, there's a long and sordid history of the negative impact on socioeconomic rights as well as political rights based on the interventions of international financial institutions in developing countries, whereby human right holders were left to direct their claims to enfeebled governments as the traditional state duty bearers under the relevant human rights treaties, while the international financial institutions wearing their non-state actor hat could claim, as they still do, that they have very limited, if any, international human rights obligations. So it's not surprising to hear comparisons between structural adjustment then, and indeed a former World Bank official gave a talk here last year at the LSE where that's exactly what he said. So what we see, of course, is that the peril of ignoring history is that it will be repeated. The second peril is that of what I call here a disciplinary supremacy. So economists and dictators might argue that fixing the economy is a first-order demand. From there, rights will flow. Mainstream orthodox. I'm sure I'm offending half the people in this room, but we can talk about the point of that. The idea that fixing the economy is a first-order demand, and from there, rights will flow, not least since we'll have money to afford them. But as we've learned from many experiences around the world, that without participation, transparency, democratic oversight, we cannot know who will benefit and how and at what cost to the people and indeed to the environment. The idea of sustainable development I don't see anywhere in the considerations that have taken place over the last 5 years, or very little. Moreover, this approach has all values of putting economics first, has all values subsumed by the values of the dominant economic policy of the day, neoliberal policies, largely neoliberal policies, and all successes are measured through that particular metric. So this is the peril. I call it here disciplinary supremacy, but really it's a peril that comes from putting economics before politics. The third peril, the peril of external repression. Control from outside the domestic polity robs people and country of their sense of sovereignty. There are a range of backlashes. We've seen them in Greece. We see them in many other places. And historically, backlash includes the rise of nationalisms, the erosion of solidarity required for effective collective action, which is needed for all sorts of endeavors globally, trafficking, climate change, conflict prevention. External control, no matter how influential and powerful, brings its own set of perils, which seems to have been completely overlooked in the way in which things have been structured and the relationship, and indeed, I would say, a coercion that took place in the situation, in the Greek situation, in the Greek negotiations and conclusions of those agreements. And finally, the peril of assumptions. So separate from the instrumental hazards that come from my first point, ignoring history, ignoring participation and the rule of law, ignoring the human instinct to respond fervently to external control and lack of power, there's a loss that this tragic transnational era of austerity has foregrounded. It's robbed people of living lives of dignity. And on the matter of dignity, the Greek case, this Greek situation, has exposed two dangerous assumptions from the engagement between Greece and its so-called international partners. One, human dignity as an intrinsic value is worthless. And second, dignity is seen to have no instrumental value. Why? Because it cannot stimulate the economy. Thank you.
Thanks, Margot.
Overtime.
No, we're very grateful for the account, and it's very, it's a very provocative argument, but it's one which allows us to focus on some of the issues and tensions between law, or rather rights, and capitalism. Can I abuse my role and make three points, and then I'm going to open it up? A lot seems to depend on the proper application of non-retrogression of social rights and well-being. It seems, on the one hand, is there an implication here that non-retrogression would inevitably, inherently, be contradicted if there was an attempt to overcome the fiscal indiscipline of a government? In the Greek case, there was clearly a sense that previous governments had been profligate, and therefore there was a need to cut back on those things. Are you saying that the principle of non-retrogression would be contradicted, for example, if we took away the right to a pension of, e.g., a public sector worker age 50 and made that 65? Is that contravening that principle? We're taking something away which had been acquired over time? Or Are you saying that non-retrogression simply means that the crisis or anti-crisis measures should be temporary and socially equitable?
Mm-hmm.
That's the first point. If I could add a couple of more points. Of course, this, in this unusual case of a bailout, we have a principle of human rights, which could be seen in different contexts. So, to put it pejoratively, we're balancing the human rights of a Greek voter and that of a German voter.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, why should we assume that the human rights of one country can be divorced from those of another in terms of paying for the bailout? Why should a taxpayer in Germany pay, in this case, in the Greek bailouts? And it brings me to the third point, which is perhaps the more generic question. I appreciate the references to the international declarations, but are we not left simply to conclude that in the context of capitalism, the constitutionalization of economic rights is simply an illusion? That is, that economies would, under capitalism, at least inevitably fluctuate over time. And if we're saying that human rights cannot be damaged in the sense of retrogression, then don't we have a fundamental problem with the nature, upholding the nature of the economy? So it's a question of whether we can constitutionalize human rights in an economic sense in the context of a capitalist system. That said, I particularly liked your phrase about economists and dictators.
I stuck that in because there's human rights teachers talk with their students all the time about so when they're introducing human rights and some of the debates about the Asian values debate, and some of the Asian values debate is around this idea that they have different values and part of those values are collective, and that's to build up the economy, and that democracy will flow from a robust economy. But really, the only people who say that are dictators, because democracy doesn't suit them well, and it's to entrench their own power. So the idea of economists and dictators was really meant to suggest that. That the thinking sort of coalesces around that idea. Okay. Okay, so maybe I'll try and offer a few reflections on those very interesting questions. So non-retrogression. So I think the first point, and I made it in my lecture about non-retrogression, because it comes up all the time, and that's this idea that non-retrogression is really, and maybe my colleagues here will have something to add to that, is really about resituating our priorities and imposing certain procedural hurdles, right? I think that came through, checking on where the money's going, who it's going to, who will be affected, is anybody falling below this minimum, and so forth. So it's not about freezing the possibility for any cutbacks where that's recognized. And I think there's questions around who makes those decisions, how they were made in Greece, how they were imposed, and so on. So it's not about refusing to modify economic policy that might have an impact on the exercise of rights, but it sets parameters around the way that's done to ensure that, at a minimum, the most vulnerable aren't impacted. And I think with regards to that, the idea of non-retrogression, that the courts have a particularly important role to play because they, in a sense, are the arbiters of whether that threshold has been crossed, ideally, right? An impartial body that looks, and that's exactly what's been happening both within Greece, within other countries that are under austerity, and the Social Rights Committee in the Greek cases, what they do is take a step back and say, have these policies impacted on the ability of people to exercise their rights? What's worrying, what's particularly worrying is that in the third MOU, the creditors have introduced something that I find extremely shocking. And under the category called fiscal risks, They include social rights and courts. The idea being that where courts make a decision that a violation of the right to Social Security has been found, right, and that means that the state has to revisit its Social Security policy, that that's considered a fiscal risk, right? That might upset the budget, upset the balance, upset the parameters, and what the government is required to do is to make changes within the existing fiscal parameters that have been set.
Right.
That is in direct contravention of basic principles of the rule of law, of the separation of powers, of the role of judiciary, and in fact undermines a lesser interventionist approach where they would just look and say, this has crossed over the threshold. The Social Rights Committee at the European level in these Greek cases had an interesting formulation, I thought, when they found a violation. And just from memory, it included... That this group of people, that you know, the pensioners that had been impacted by the Social Security cuts, couldn't live in conditions of dignity given the cumulative cutbacks. It wasn't one impact; it was a series of cutbacks over time, and that this did violence to their settled and legitimate financial expectations, what they had grown accustomed to. You know. And that's not, one can say, well, I've grown accustomed to driving a Porsche and anything less just won't do. But of course, we're not talking about that distortion of the truth. We're talking about what they've grown accustomed to live on and indeed what their requirements are, what they have to pay off. Do they have children? Do they have a disabled child that requires special needs? Do they have loans? Do they have a mortgage? Right.
So just a small follow-up. Isn't there then an ambiguity for the court to enter this field that... Hypothetically, you could have a situation in which someone is low paid but given an early retirement age and a pension.
Mm-hmm.
We had to counterbalance that with other taxpayers, other redistributive policies.
Mm-hmm.
Can a court do that? We might talk about economists and dictators, but what about judges and...
Well, it's an interesting point. I mean, there's a big debate, and you've put your finger right on it, there's a big debate among lawyers about the proper role of courts, and indeed whether social rights are justiciable, right? Whether they should be the business of courts.
Okay.
Because they impact on budgetary considerations and areas and so forth. Okay. And the idea is really that they don't make budgets, that they check to make sure they're okay. That they're non-discriminatory, that they address these basic social needs. And so they have a watchdog function rather than a policymaking function. Okay. There's other hands. Can I just say two brief points with regards to Kevin's other points? So the Greek voter, German voter question, which is a good one. So just two quick thoughts. One is that the German voter... So one point is that the IMF... So there was discussion around debt forgiveness, debt restructuring, and the IMF and France and Germany and in part Greece didn't want it back in 2010 in part because they wanted to bail out their banks with the money, right? So that first loan, in fact, didn't go to Greece. And Varoufakis writes about it in his commentary, in one of his commentaries to the MOU, that money went to bail out those banks. And I think 10% went to Greek expenditure. In that sense, private debt bank was converted into public debt of the German taxpayer. So that was an active decision of their government to burden them, in a sense, with this debt and to burden the Greek people now with repaying this unsustainable debt. In fact, the IMF amended its articles of agreement in order to lend when it knew it was lending unsustainably. At the pressure of France and Germany and Greece at the time. So the idea that somehow they were victims of this, and out of the generosity and now they're repaying, I think there's a more complicated story. But I think there's a more interesting point as sort of academics and people who think about these issues that you've really raised and I think I want to reflect on later. And that is we talk about obligations of, and that was what my talk was about tonight, of all these different international actors and what they owe to people elsewhere. And we can also talk about different states and what they owe to people far away, right? That's sort of it's a new area and it's evolving, but that's the conversation, a diagonal obligation, if you will, rather than Greece to its own people. We have this kind of diagonal thing. But what I think you're inviting with your Greek taxpayer, your Greek voter, a German voter example is that in a globalized world, what we have to do is not only recognize sort of transnational obligations, but transnational burden sharing, right? Now it's not really about the distribution of the burdens in Greece, but the distribution of the burdens around, among all peoples implicated.
Yes, yes.
And so I could see a transnational distribution of burdens that would allow the German taxpayer to absorb some of those hits because they're part of this story and implicated in this story. Final point. Do I remember your final point?
I think you've probably covered it in the sense of can we constitutionalize economic rights.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Okay, good.
Oh, okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have several people. Vasily first.
Thank you.
Can you tell me who you're here? Yeah.
I'm an economist, not a dictator.
Okay. I sort of lumped them together.
Come see,
yeah.
Come
see. Yeah, sorry about that line, but at least I got your attention in case you were snoozing.
So you mentioned also in the beginning that the lenders exporting capitalism, and then of course, you know, talking about sort of a neoliberal recipe which suppressed human rights, civil rights, or other rights. And then I was thinking, okay, you know, if not capitalism, what? And two examples came to mind. Mm-hmm. One, I think, I don't know the history of the Soviet Union very well, but the Soviets bailing out Bulgaria at some point, and I don't have intimate knowledge of the case, but not very much caring about human rights in Bulgaria. And then another example, from ancient Greece, the Athenians saving Thebes, and also not caring about, the contrary, you know, so violating human rights in a huge scale, and of course in a different era where human rights were not appreciated as much. So anyway, my question is this perhaps the fact that it's a neoliberal recipe, is it more coincidental because everything is neoliberal, so that would also be neoliberal? And really the key factor is the external repression. So whenever you have somebody saving you, or saving you, if you choose, there's some conditionality that will always be from the receiving end, a perception at least, if not a reality, of violation of human rights or repression of rights or whatever. So the question is the neoliberalism is there, it just happens.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. It's an interesting question. So I think the point is that the international creditors, in my account, and I think it's a reasonable account of international human rights law, would be required to consider their obligations in the context of people in far-off places, regardless of what they were doing. The external dimension, their role as external actors, doesn't and shouldn't preclude them from taking on certain duties because they impact on the exercise of rights. So I think that relationship stands regardless of the policies that they were pursuing. It happens to be that the policies have failed on economic terms, and failed in terms of any reasonable standard of social justice, however framed, human rights or otherwise. So it shows us that we need them more than ever, but it's not the nature of neoliberalism that creates those obligations. It's the fact that where there's power, there has to be constraints on the exercise of that power. Human rights is a model that offers those constraints, imperfect as it is. And if someone asks me about the mechanisms to address this, you'll see how limited our options are. So it's by far a perfect model, but it's one model that we have. But the point is that those obligations are there, or those duties are there, irregardless of the policies. Of the content, exactly. They're not born of neoliberalism. Neoliberalism just happens to shine a light on what they are because they've been so egregious.
Thanks. There are a number of people wanting to
ask
questions.
I'm going to be shorter.
Are you happy to take a group of questions?
I can take three, but after that, I'll start showing my age because I'm...
Bernard.
Can tell me who you are, though, please.
Yeah, yeah. Bernard Casey from LSE, sort of the Hellenic Observatory, and also LSE Health.
Okay, LSE Health.
I'm suffering from disciplinary supremacy. Not because I'm an economist, which I am quite pleased to be, and my partner is an is a lawyer, so I have to learn to live with these people. But I'm actually suffering because your discipline makes you put your references as footnotes and compresses them together, and therefore I can't see some of the people in you cite. I wondered, I started off with the problem which Kevin raised, which is, can we constitutionalise human rights? And I was thinking of these
economic rights in a market economy.
And rights, yes. Sorry, economic and social rights. Mm-hmm. That was what I was thinking of, because I was thinking a number of years ago, listening to somebody called Alvin Sachs from South Africa talking about this in the theatre over the road there. And he was actually talking about the very specific case where there had been an attempt to do this within the constitution of post-apartheid South Africa. Mm-hmm. And actually, even he, who was trying very hard, recognised the limitations on this, even where it had been attempted to be very explicit. So that was my first question. Had you referred to him? I couldn't find it, but then I couldn't find it because of the way you write him. The next question is, just in relation to that, is, well, if this is what is going on, why is it being done? Now, you might say, you know, well, why has somebody taken from one of these instances where you can actually prosecute people or charge people for failing to do this? And why are people behaving in the way that they are, which seems to be terribly bad, according to your judgment? And I ended up by thinking of 1984 and George Orwell, because somewhere towards the end of this, the protagonist of this actually is discussing with the people who have been oppressing him and says, why are you doing this? And they say to him, you foolish person, we are not doing this for your own good. We are doing this because we like torturing you and we like creating pain. Is that actually what you are suggesting that these international organisations, etc., are doing?
Okay, thank you, we got that. There are several people. I thought there was someone here. No? Okay. Can we take you first?
I have one very brief question.
Can you just say who you are?
Sorry, I'm Laura, I'm a student here.
She's an LLM student, but she doesn't want to say it in this room.
Okay.
Oh, you're not? You're an MSc human rights student? Okay. No? Even though? Okay. Go on. Law and anthropology.
The first question is, in front of an international treaty body, would a Greek person have the possibility to sue, for example, Germany? Or is it just in front towards Greece? And then a little bit more open question, where, in the consultation where you evolve, did the story of bailouts, for example, towards Latin American countries or New York during the 70s?
I'm sorry, which is?
Like the story of bailouts and with structural adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
Did this history of Latin American countries and New mm-hmm. York ever come up? And the lessons, for example, learned there mm-hmm. and like the effects of structural adjustment, not just towards human rights, but as well towards economic development?
Okay, shall we?
Should I answer? Oh, no, one more, you're
one
saying?
One more.
Whew, ambitious. Okay.
Angela. Oh, so I'm sorry. Wrong question.
Similarly, I'm
sorry.
PhD student here at the European Institute. One question, I was wondering if you could elaborate further on the role of human rights in the case of private creditors, which were, in a way, the bulk in the beginning of the sovereign debt crisis, because, in a way, it seems you put a lot of focus on the institutions. And then, related to this, I wonder, if the lessons that, the mistakes that the IMF or other institutions have made in the past are really applicable to the Greek case, being, Greece a developed country. So in a way, Greece was also the first one of the developed countries not to pay back the IMF, and therefore defaulting on it. And I think the other examples that you mentioned, being India or the transition economies in the East, in a way, they went through a huge suffering, but in the case of Greece, there is a lot of blame also to be put on who governed Greece until 2009 and all the mistakes that they made. And in a way, the EU institutions bailed out Greece, and I'm not saying that the Troika did a good job. I'm just saying, in a way, you know, like taking also the place of the private creditors at some point was needed because, like, through private creditors, probably the measures would have been even harsher.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, LSE Health. Do they just like to inflict pain? So there's a, you know, there's a whole host of theories going around, and I imagine it's a combination of a number of them, about why this was handled in this way. And in particular with a focus on the Eurozone countries. And so part of it, and I find it credible, but this is not my independent research, this is what I've read, and everybody's read it too, the idea that doing violence to Greece was a way to repress a rising left in Europe, particularly Podemos. You don't, okay, you're asking if they like to inflict pain. There's no economist that I read, and in fact, if anybody's interested in reading Ashok Amadi, who's an IMF defector very recently, his work is fantastic, and he, in fact, you know, sort of certifies many of the assumptions that were there. Not necessarily on this issue, but generally speaking. So my point about Amadi is that he writes, as did some others, that no serious economist supported austerity in these conditions, and it was imposed nonetheless. So one has to turn and say, well, why was it imposed? What are the reasons? And then all sorts of reasons have come up. So part of it was that, you know, some countries that have contributed to the bailout had undergone their own austerity, and they didn't want to then turn around and say, we're going to let other countries off without imposing the same kind of conditions that we just suffered under. And then it's the rise of Podemos, and let's say, let's decimate the left. And frankly, and I should be careful because I'm being recorded, but they did a fantastic job. I mean, Syriza, in many ways, has been decimated compared to what it was and what it was meant to be. At best, it's a social democratic party, and it's a social democratic party without it being able to implement any social democratic policy. So so there was great. So your guess is as good as mine, but it wasn't economic. It wasn't good economic policy making. And so let's speculate on what did motivate.
Could you say in parallel to that an alternative explanation that it's the, if you wish, the tyranny of ordo-liberal thinking? So that would any serious economist support such a policy? I suppose there were serious economists in Germany who believe in ordo-liberalism, who thought it was not only effective, but morally justified.
Yeah. On that...
Sorry?
Yeah. On that, I'll say...
Sorry, I'm a good Hayekian.
Okay.
Okay.
On that, I just want to say I'll give a sort of promote my colleague in the law department, Mike Wilkinson, who wrote a little policy brief. So the law department produces these four pagers on Grexit and the euro, where he discusses these issues in a very subtle and interesting way. So you might want to see Mike's paper, and he raises exactly that issue.
Thanks.
About the tensions between two visions, including.
Okay.
Laura. So.
I'll be sad.
Did they refer to South Africa?
Have you made any reference to
the constitutionalization of economic rights?
Where? In Greece, you mean? In these discussions?
As an idea of whether this was Kevin's question.
Albie Sachs was a judge of the South African Constitutional Court, and the South African Constitution entrenches social rights. It didn't come up directly because, to be honest with you, so the people that we were working with and that were involved in this in Greece were economists and lawyers, and the economists weren't interested, nor did they need to be interested in it, and the lawyers have, in a sense, transcended that debate about the justiciability of socioeconomic rights in South Africa's revolution, for the purposes of this.
It was about the point that he was talking about.
Yeah.
It was not about South Africa.
What was
it? It was about constitutionalizing socioeconomic rights.
South Africa is not the only country to do that. There's many constitutions that have entrenched socioeconomic rights, and there's an interesting debate going on whether it's the proper role of the judiciary to oversee them.
Yeah.
But in terms of its place here, in fact, it would have been great to have had the Greek court more involved, and in the future their positions will be significant and their rulings will be significant.
But also, I guess, so much of the argument rests on a distinctive European frame of the European commitments in terms of the declarations that you referred to. So therefore, where someone making reference in South Africa is irrelevant to the particular frame.
In a formal sense, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. That's right. So, Laura, in short, this, in my view, will depend on how the committee, under the optional protocol that allows for complaints to be brought to the Committee on Economic, Social, Culture Rights, it's just entered into force recently, so they're just starting to take cases, the just disability of economic, social, culture rights at the international level. And I think much of that, I think it will take some time. But in my view, the possibility, and I wrote about this in a book edited by Malcolm Langford a couple of years ago, it will turn on the interpretation of the word jurisdiction, people within their jurisdiction, which isn't limited to territory, as we know, but does jurisdiction include the jurisdiction of the IMF if they're imposing conditionality on Greek people? And then how do you sort of disaggregate that, right, the member states of the IMF through some procedure. So fairly complicated, not fully anticipated, but not ruled out either, I would say, through a creative interpretation. Did Latin America come up? Yeah, it came up because there was I can't say entirely sort of global representation, but a good representation from here and there, including a woman who had worked on debt audits in Latin America. She was Brazilian, but she had worked elsewhere. I think it was Uruguay who had a big... So there are people who came with experience from evaluating the debts in other countries, part of citizens' debt initiatives and so forth, and that came up. The independent expert on human rights and foreign debt, an independent UN appointment, is an Argentinian lawyer, and he's on mission in Greece, and in fact, he finishes today. So his press release should be out on the UN website very soon about his findings on Greece, which may be interesting. My point merely is that he has experience with the Argentinian situation and will no doubt have it inform tacitly, if not explicitly, his work there. Private creditors, I haven't worked on private creditors, so I'm not really going to sort of venture an answer there. Greece and the IMF. What did I mean by that? I don't know. Do you know what I meant by that?
Yeah, in a way, the criticism that are given to the IMF toward, like, for their mistakes in the past are really applicable in the case of Greece.
Oh. Yeah. So it's an interesting question, and you know, I think something to consider is, you know, so part of it is a geopolitical question, right, for sort of an IR scholar, and that's the shifting balance of power in the world and how that plays out within these institutions. Within the IMF and the World Bank, it's a weighted voting system. So one question that comes to mind, just thinking sort of out loud about your comment, is European countries hold a lot of power, because the weighted voting system is based on how rich the countries are, effectively, their contribution. So the U.S. is the most single, but collectively, the European countries have a lot of clout, and that would include Greece. So Greece is now not part of sort of this poor developing country up against countries with a lot of voting clout. It's now part of that conversation. So the dynamics within the IMF and the World Bank are quite different, one would imagine. And in a sense, raising this quote by Roumeliotis is interesting, because he came saying we're going to take care of the vulnerable people and then sat down around the table, and it seems to me that he might as well have been any other country, because he sat down there negotiating the terms of the loan, and it ceased in a way to matter that he was a European country, part of this European club with collective weight when they voted. He was now a debtor nation getting a loan and speaking to the creditors, and they were dictating those terms. So I wonder how different it is within those institutions when push comes to shove. And the final point on that is when there was discussions in the IMF about lending to Greece in 2009, and recognition that the debt was unsustainable, and on normal terms, the IMF would not lend in the circumstances that were in Greece at the time. There were a number of developing, emerging economies who raised the issue and said that we're really uncomfortable with this. In the end, as I said, the Articles of Agreement were amended with the push by a handful of European states to do that. So shifting power within the IMF, but ultimately, I think in that case, they got the U.S. on board as well. There's some discussion around getting the U.S. on board and so on.
There's a question, a very interesting question from our friend here as to whether a Greek could sue Germany. You raised this question.
Which you answered.
I answered that about a Greek person's bringing a case against. Yeah, I answered it sort of in code. I answered it very quickly. Not really in code, but you don't. Just it. Okay.
We're almost at the end. Any last questions or comments before we close?
Why is Argentina relevant
in
South Africa is not?
Okay.
Let me ask my usual question about the counterfactual. So, really following from Angelo's question, in legal terms, if not signing the memorandum would have led to, let's say, bigger human rights violations or bigger misery, is there legally a case to say that even if, you know, taking the positive action of signing the memorandum creates a violation, this is in order to correct a foreseeable bigger violation? Do you understand? It does make sense. But how do we know the counterfactual here as well? So what I'm saying is that if people acted in good faith trying to alleviate a catastrophe, and in doing that, you know, I try to save somebody's life, and in doing that, I break their leg. Surely, you know, must be discounted that they had good intentions. At the end of the day, the person didn't die, rather than go to jail because of, you know, of being aggressive and breaking someone's leg. So, is there a legal thing for that?
I mean, what it comes to mind immediately is not so much a legal response, but really to say, to sort of go back to the politics from what I learned. Being in Athens and so on, was merely that there was discussion back in 2009 about allowing about different options for Greece, including restructuring the debt and so forth, which were taken off the table for 2 years or so in order that all this money could be lent, which wasn't going to go to Greece, was going to go to the banks. So the idea of alternatives, I think, really has to be questioned. What got us to the place of that MOU and those conditionalities in the first place? But I think maybe as a lawyer, just sort of as a general point, but maybe as a legal point, I would question whether there was good faith. I think the information. I mean, everybody watched. I think every reasonable, decent person in this world watched with horror the negotiations this summer with the Eurogroup and Tsipras and Varoufakis and all that kind of stuff, with horror. That couldn't have been, in my view, good faith. I think that and it's something that I'll study, so I'm apprehensive to say too much now, but I think in a general sense, I think that there was real coercion that took place. Even the way the negotiations were handled was coercive. The Committee on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, in their comment on Greece that came out in October.
I'm asking more about the Greek government. So, if the Greek government hadn't asked for help and then, you know, live with the conditionality, then can they argue legally that, my view was that if I hadn't asked for help, the situation for Greece would become more intolerable? So,
yes.
And there's an implication, isn't there, that in terms of public-private, so that if they didn't ask for a international organisation rescuing, but left it to the financial markets and loans, etc., from private banks, then what's the difference in terms of the harm or the guilt of such a strategy?
I'm disinclined to accept a lesser evil discussion when things when lives are at stake. I think that we can evaluate what might have been a different course of action for Greece and whether they made the best made the best decisions at the time. But there's many many ways in which they were circumscribed in what they could do. And there's many ways in which they were responsible for having arrived at that situation in the first place themselves, and many ways in which they were not. So I think this is a far bigger conversation, to have. But the idea of the lesser evil, the idea of no alternatives, and so forth, I think limits our imagination and plays into some of the attempts, I think, to crush dissenting voices and to narrow the frame of alternatives. And I think now we really need alternatives.
I think you need to have to elaborate that question.
Triages, I mean, this is in these sort of circumstances, you move into a disaster, you categorize the people who you see around you who've been affected into three groups, and there is one group who would definitely survive, and therefore you devote attention to them. There is one group who might possibly survive, and there is one group who is in real difficulties but probably won't survive at all. And the obligation then is to ignore the third group, work on the first group in the first instance, because you would definitely get a benefit out of it, and the second group you will allocate something. Triage is the term. It's a term which is worth thinking about.
Okay, we seem to have entered a moral maze here, but I appreciate it.
The lecture next week will be from our friend from LSE Health.
Okay,
so we'll hear more of what your suggestions are.
Okay. That's fine. We are out of time, but thank you, Margot, very much indeed for raising all of these issues and being willing to respond to the questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.